Swamiji made the interesting statement once that he saw all sentient creatures as essentially the same, which is on a spectrum between identification with the physical body, identification with the ego, and freedom from all those self-definitions in the spirit. And he said, even animals, it's just a matter of degree. It's not really like there's some sudden break. Everything is conscious and everything is moving forward. All rivers are flowing to the sea, and whether it's the great Mississippi or a little tiny creek in some backwoods, it's all moving in the same direction. And really then, insofar as we are defined by the direction of our energy, it's really all the same thing. Even though it's normally stated that self-realization is only possible when you have a human body, at the ashram of Ramana Maharshi in India, there is a Mahasamadhi Mandir, which is to say a temple dedicated to a self-realized soul for the cow Lakshmi, who was so devoted to the guru that he was able to have that cow skip all of the human stages and go directly to self-realization. I'm not a disciple of Ramana Maharshi, and I don't know the details of it. That's simply what he said. Now, was this a high yogi who came back to be a cow so that he could serve Ramana Maharshi? Was he really just an animal on the way up who'd just gotten to be a cow and then just had this terrific burst of good karma? There's a story told about Anandamayi Ma, a great saint in India, and she was being troubled by this fly that kept landing on her face, and they kept brushing it away. And finally she said to her devotees, leave it. She says, it's a great saint who wanted to be near this body. She never called herself self. He wanted to be near this body, let him be. The lifespan of a fly, of course, is very short, so he just hovered up next to Anandamayi Ma and got her darshan for the period of what? There are many things that go on this planet that are not so simple to get. That this is where the woo-woo music comes in. If we could cue the choir over here, we'll just make that happen. If you were still at the piano, Todd, you could do it for us. Okay. In any case, Lahiri Mahashaya also, one of the gurus of our own line here, also was said to have been working on a technique. I mean, what these words actually mean, I don't know. To have been working on a technique that would allow animals to become liberated without having to go through the human stage. It's kind of annoying when you're trapped in the human stage, but nor can one even begin with the little tiny bit of understanding that I have to just figure out how on earth that would work. By the way, actually, in Ramana Maharshi's ashram, there's also a crow. There's also a temple to a crow. Lakshmi the cow is better known, but there was also a crow. Now, it's always interesting, and whenever we have classes about reincarnation, people are always asking the question. It's a natural question to ask about animals. And many people have devoutly told me that they know their cat, you know, either was or will be a human being, or their dog, or their parakeet, or whatever it is. Master himself told his disciple, Dr. Lewis, that their cat would in fact be a human being in the next lifetime, because it had had the karma to be close to such elevated consciousness in Dr. Lewis himself, and Master visiting the house, petting the cat, spending time with the cat, all of a sudden it got quite zingy and went way forward. That what Master explains is that on the animal level, on the level of the plants and the animals and the crystals, that the evolution is automatic, is how he puts it. I mean, I always love the image of the water flowing to the ocean. The rivers don't sit and think about it. You know, the Pacific is closer than the Atlantic. I think I'll head for the Pacific, or I would really rather merge in the Arabian Sea. Maybe I can go around this way and do it. It's just an automatic attraction. And so Master says, we move through the animal stages by the pressure of mass karma that just automatically awakens us. Now, there is the participatory element in it, because so much of what happens, if you watch, especially when you're watching slightly more evolved but even little ones, animals don't just do things for practical reasons. You can tell that they're having experiences. They're curious, they're excited. God bless the internet, which awakens us to things that we never would have seen anywhere. Recently, I saw a tiny penguin laughing as its belly was tickled. I mean, Master said it's very good karma for animals to come in contact with humans, because it does put them in contact with a completely different kind of consciousness and does speed their evolution. So when some otherwise wild animal, in this case a wild animal rescue, because the little tiny penguin being tickled had a bandage on its poor little injured foot. But there it was enjoying. It found out that there was this giant thing that would come down from the sky, like this five-fingered thing, and it would touch its belly, and it enjoyed it, and then it would move forward and try to get it again. Swamiji tells us that the quality of feeling, you see, is inherent in all of creation. Even as he put it, if you stick a pin in a worm and cause that worm pain, the worm will try to get away from the pain. That there are these two impulses always there. The one that moves toward what it considers at first pleasure, survival. Gradually it gets higher into happiness and so on. But it moves toward that which it finds enjoyable to experience. It moves away from that which it finds painful to experience. On the level, as I say, of animals, this becomes, it hides from predators, it seeks out the food, whatever it might be. I was having a conversation with someone about the intoxicants that exist in nature and the animals' enthusiasm for those intoxicants. The birds that go after the pyracantha berries and they get a little drunk. We used to have one many, many years ago. I lived in a place with a huge pyracantha bush. And at a certain season, I looked outside and there were, and I'm not kidding, there were robins staggering around on the lawn. And they were having trouble taking off because they had gotten drunk on the pyracantha berries. I was told recently by someone from India that there's a certain fruit, a certain big tree. I'm not sure whether the fruit is good for humans or not, but the monkeys love it. And it goes overripe and ferments. And then the monkeys flock to it. And then you have a whole crowd of drunk monkeys. Now, the part of this that I was so interested in is on the level of the spiritual path as we follow it, the three major delusions that are offered are sexuality, which represents the pleasure of the body in all its forms, the desire for money, which is the desire for power and control, and then the desire for wine, which represents intoxicants, which is to give ourselves a holiday from our ordinary consciousness. I mean, the desire to just have a holiday from how we feel without having actually to work to transform ourselves, it's immensely tempting, don't you think so? I mean, we might not be drug addicts or alcoholics anymore, although maybe some of us are. But we're still, you know, we think, oh, I've had a hard day at work. I think I'll just turn on the television. Oh, I've been good all week. I think I'll eat that whole pint of ice cream, you know, or I'll pick up my novel. I'll just read my novel. So my dear husband said to me one day that I suffered from TMN. He was right. Too many novels. That was my drug of choice for many years of my life. Just life was too much. I'd open a novel to the point where I actually had to discipline myself not to do it. It was just that desire to effortlessly get out of being myself. Do the monkeys have this existential longing not to be monkeys anymore? Do the robins, like, no, I can get a break from being a robin by gobbling up these red berries? It's just fascinating to contemplate, isn't it? Now, everything in nature is moving forward in this way. And as our reading was talking about today, what characterizes human beings and what does indeed make us the highest species on the planet, even though we would like sentimentally to think that's not so, the masters declare it, is that human beings can consciously consider our own reality. We have the self-consciousness to recognize that we are human beings. We are not monkeys. We are I've been at Ananda Village last week. Ananda Village is our rural community, which has become, there have always been a lot of deer on that property. In fact, on the first day of hunting season, we would notice there would be more deer on that property. Now it's generational. They know, I mean, for 40 years, they know it's safe. And they're so, they're just everywhere. You're always bumping into them. There used to be a one flock of wild turkeys up at the seclusion retreat, but now there's also wild turkeys everywhere, just everywhere you go, and they have this most horrible cry. First time I heard it, I thought they'd gotten a new bell at the Expanding Light, and it was more like an air horn, but it was just the turkeys just chattering with each other. Turkeys are, you know the phrase, what a turkey, and you're like talking about someone not being really very with it. When you hang around turkeys, you can see where it comes from. They have very big bodies and very small heads. And, you know, there's just not much in the head there. And they wander around, and they're everywhere. There's also a whole lot of wild geese. And these are just the ones that just kind of you stumble over everywhere you go. And I was really conscious of the fact that up there we are really living in a crowd of human and non-human creatures. And this must be much more like how the American Indians lived. They were just always in constant interaction with the creatures around them. But the deer really don't actually know what we are, because they don't have the self-consciousness to define themselves. I am a deer and you are a human. You know, I am a turkey and you are a wild goose. They can't say that out loud, because they don't have the development to see themselves. And when we have the development to see ourselves, that's when real evolution can get underway. Or that's when we can thwart it like crazy, because we can now start making choices. You know, which way do I really want to go with my consciousness? And what's so interesting, I was thinking also about snakes falling out of their skins. You know, how a certain point comes when a snake knows that the skin is finished. Every once in a while up there in Ananda Village, because of rattlesnakes, so often you'd find an empty snake skin, which are just, empty snake skins are just so marvelous. And you find the horns of the deer sometimes have been discarded. It's like this whole part of that living entity, it just suddenly isn't required anymore, and they push it back. And that's exactly the same way that when the body isn't required anymore, they just let it go. Speaking of the American Indians, they would always talk about when they would hunt or, you know, go to a herd and they would need buffalo for the winter, they would pray to the devas, really, that were in charge of the buffalo, and say, here we are on this land together and we're happy to share this land with you, but some of you have to help us. And then they would always feel that the buffalo that they would shoot had decided it was time. And it would separate itself out. And many mystical stories about, it's not this aggressive desire to kill, but it's this cooperative effort. And the buffalo would decide, I'm done being a buffalo. I'm happy to become your teepee now, or to just give up this body and let you use it in any way that you will. Because this certain point comes, and Swami writes about that in his 14 steps, the Raja Yoga course it's called now, Art and Science of Raja Yoga. There's a sentence in there that's so interesting to me. We manifest the soul, the individual spirit, manifests the body that allows us to express the full realized potential at that point of our consciousness. In the book I've just published, the Ask Asha, the last question was a very heartfelt question from a friend who had a Great Dane, a dog that she really loved. She moved from a house to a small apartment. It was impossible to keep the Great Dane. The family she gave the dog to, it didn't work out, and the dog ended up having to be put to sleep. And she was just absolutely riddled with pain and guilt over the fact that this dog had been put to sleep, its life had been ended. So I wrote a very long answer, because many, many issues are involved there. But one of the things I said to her was, the individual spirit, even of an animal, because even though it's not self-conscious, the individuality is still there. which will eventually become who we become, we manifest the body that allows us to express the limit of our consciousness. And as soon as as soon as that body becomes a burden instead of an asset to our soul's journey to rejoin the ocean, to our expansion of consciousness, then in that moment the body goes away. Whether we're an 85-year-old person taking our last breath surrounded by three generations of progeny, whether it's a cat that crawls off into the woods to die, whether it was Master's pet deer described in Autobiography of a Yogi, who Master was trying to keep out alive out of love for him, but came to Master in a dream and said, "You've got to let me go. I'm just a fawn, but I'm finished. I've done what I can do here. Let me go on." Or, as I wrote to my friend, you know, being a Great Dane is a fairly good deal, as dogs go. You know, I mean, you would think a Great Dane would be more advanced than a Chihuahua, but who's to say? You're only just looking at them. But after all, like, how much potential does it really have? You know, you can sniff around and you can be fed and you can be excited. You can take a walk and then you can take a nap. And then you can meet other little dogs and then you can go out into the woods and you can take a walk and then you can take a nap. I mean, how much can you really do? You can't read Shakespeare. You can't learn Kriya. There's a limit. Would you have wanted that poor soul of your dog to remain a Great Dane forever? What a really depressing prospect. And when she was through being a Great Dane, would you have wanted her to stay there just so that you wouldn't feel bad? And so with us now, we have egos. And our identification is, so infinitely more complex. And our sense of the possible and what we can do and the desires that we have and what gives us pleasure and what gives us pain. And each one of us is so, I'm always just amazed how remarkably individualized we are. I mean, just starting from the faces we made and the hair and the eyes and the gender and the culture. And then it goes on and on to our preference for a black and red color scheme or our passion for lavender or whatever it might be. It goes on and on and on. All these very subtle self-identifications that the ego has grasped. And that's just the one incarnation. We don't even know how many others before. But the soul is on a very different journey. And the journey we're on is not stopping here. As Swamiji said, we're all on a spectrum. And when Master was asked if evolution has any end, his answer was no. We just keep evolving until we achieve endlessness. So looking at anything that we love and that we think is so important and the passion of our families and the opportunity to raise our grandchildren or to have that home that we wanted or whatever it might be, it's not an end in itself. It's our self-awareness acting out where it thinks its happiness is going to come from as a necessary stage as the bubble goes to the sea. And as soon as we have learned whatever it is it has to teach us, then just like the snake, we just slide right out of that skin, don't we? And so many things, all of us, everyone has had loss and change and inevitable things that we didn't seek but we had to accept, and skin sometimes that instead of slipping out of them have been peeled off, and antlers that have been broken. And sometimes, of course, for many incarnations before this one, the whole body is finished. Or suddenly we just find out, oh my goodness, whereas I thought I had many more years to learn through this incarnation, turns out I don't. You know, at any moment, this can happen to us. We all have stories. Just heard a story recently of a friend. You go in for the routine operation and it turns out not to be routine. A friend of mine, his 5-mile jog every day was giving him a backache. And it just didn't seem to go away. So he went to the hospital and discovered he died 2 weeks later. He just had cancer all through him. Strong, you know, powerful, and then thing like that. He was finished with that body. Would we hold ourselves or the people we love, our pets, one moment longer in that which is no longer serving to expand their body, their consciousness, but is now holding it back? And it's not just our physical body. It's the attitudes we hold, the resentments, the misunderstandings. You know, when will we let these skins go? Our ego serves us at the beginning. That's what Swami writes today. It was so interesting. It serves us at the beginning. At the beginning of our spiritual journey, our egos are very important. Ego in this sense, I am a self-conscious being. I'm a self-aware being. I can decide. I have power. I can manifest. I can make decisions. I am not a victim. I am the cause of my own incarnation. These are powerful, moving energies. But then we reach the point of self-awareness where we figure out, wait a minute, that power has never been my own, as the little bird learns in the festival every week. This power has never been my own. I am, in fact, part of a greater reality. And our self-awareness tells us, ah, the satisfaction I'm seeking is not in emphasizing this smallness, but in shedding that skin. Swami writes to us, few devotees extricate themselves from the vortex of ego all that easily because we cling. We cling to the habit of being in charge. We cling to the habit that I know that this is really what's good for me. We cling to the habit of fear and a feeling of loneliness and the hope that somehow there's got to be an easier way. When a friend of mine had a psychiatric break from reality for a period of time, I said to Swamiji, you know, my impression about him was that he was right up at the edge of the spiritual path. And when he saw what was really going to be asked of him, he decided, holiday, holiday. And Swamiji said that it's a stage of spiritual growth on that long spectrum from delusion to freedom, to just turn aside. And it's not that we become elevated in our break from reality, but we just take a holiday. I just don't want to do this. I'm just going to play over here in a world of my own creation. And when I'm done, I'll come right back to this point and realize it has to be faced. Swamiji made such a poignant remark once. He said, he's written in a book, actually, one of his books. He said, At the moment when God realization comes, he said, and you realize that there is only one reality, that all of this sense of difference is an illusion. And as Swamiji put it, you realize you are absolutely alone in creation. I mean, think about that for just a minute, because there is only, it all comes back to one. You're absolutely alone in creation. He said, for just a moment, there is a moment of intense loneliness. Isn't that odd? And then he said, bliss floods in. And you realize that that singularity is not a singularity of separateness, but of union with all. And that's the progress, the soul's long journey. Everything of our separateness that we protect and protect and protect, we suddenly realize, oh, what I'm actually seeking is to crawl right out of that skin. That this self does not serve me anymore. And then willingly, freely, with great joy, we give it up. God bless you.